Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man we've had the privilege of getting to know a bit in connection with his work on defending one of the most important aspects of the war for the free world's home front is Rick Green. He is a former Texas state representative, among other things, a documentary filmmaker. He's also a Constitution coach with the Patriot Academy. And Rick, it's good to have you back for a quick update. Thank you very much for taking the time today.
Frank, it's my honor, man. Good to be back with you.
Well, let's start with just a couple of examples of things that are now afoot that seem to be signaling a willingness to look afresh at what actually happened in 2020 and learn some lessons from it. What can you tell us about, I don't know, Maricopa County, for example, or what's going on in Georgia?
Yeah, the recount, the verification in Maricopa is encouraging. The legislation passed in Georgia is encouraging. You know, big picture wise, it's unfortunate. It's kind of like there was a crime at your business and someone broke in and stole everything and you've still not yet found the perpetrator. They got away with the crime, but at the same time, you beef up security and you make sure it doesn't happen again. So it looks like that may be the case with this presidential election, and hopefully we're going to make those changes in these key states. I personally think they're not going far enough on the protections. I'm a paper ballot guy. I've been through a recount myself in my first legislative race, and because we were able to put our hands on every ballot and both my opponent and me be able to look at each of those ballots and verify the outcome, when it changed from him winning to me winning, there were no claims of cheating, no claims of stealing the election, because we both were able to look at all of those ballots and verify the outcome. So I wish they would go further in the reforms that are being made right now, but at least they are locking down the absentee ballot debacle in Georgia and some of those positive aspects. And then hopefully it will not be completely overturned by the U.S. Congress with this, this H.R. 1, which is the worst of the worst of all of these election debacles. Whether you look at Wisconsin or Michigan or Pennsylvania, we know that the Constitution was violated, that these state legislatures were not the ones making the changes. But the things that were done are now going to be codified into federal law if they pass H.R. 1.
Yeah, I'm very worried about this, especially insofar as among the lessons we've learned in the postmortems on what happened in the 2020 elections, is that a variety of the things that are being promoted as something that should be made permanent and nationally binding in the way elections should be conducted here on out is the source of the fraud that took place in particularly the presidential race. And Rick, when you say that it's clearly constitutionally challenging, there is a provision in the Constitution that allows the federal legislature to set certain rules with respect to elections. How does that net out, as you see it, between what the states are supposed to do under the Constitution and what Congress is permitted to do?
You're exactly right, Frank. It's Article 1, Section 4, Paragraph 1, and it gives time, place, and manner of election to the state legislature. But unfortunately, there's a semicolon there in the second half of that paragraph, gives the Congress the power to step in and modify certain times some of those things. But it's only with regard to U.S. representatives and U.S. senators. And if you go back to the original intent of that clause, Hamilton helps educate us on that in Federalist, I believe it's 59 and 60, and it was really for an extreme circumstance where, you know, for instance, states would decide to not even have a federal election or to, you know, do something really, really crazy. But they're using that as an excuse to come in and completely take over elections. No voter ID, unlimited absentee ballots, no rejection of any absentee ballot. I mean, it's complete chaos that they will create. And I got to say, Frank, I don't think, you know, if they push this through, the only way to stop them on this, the temporary stop, is going to be for states to hold two different elections. They're they're going to have to separate their federal elections for U.S. House and U.S. Senate from their state elections. Otherwise, all of the elections will be corrupted and the left will be able to steal any election they want. And Texas is already floating legislation to do that. I think other states will have to do the same thing if they push this thing through. But long term, the only solution is to amend the Constitution to strike that second sentence in Article 1, Section 4, Paragraph 1. You cannot leave this up to the federal government to micromanage and take over our elections. And so that's the only way to solve this. That's why it's got to be done through a convention of states, because this Congress will never do it. So thank God for George Mason giving us that option in Article 5, where we can do this without the federal government. It's just simply a way of overruling the Congress, overruling the U.S. Supreme Court. The states should have the final say here and be able to dictate their elections and not have the federal government do so.
You see some signs, Rick Green, if I understand you correctly, that forensic work may actually shed light on what happened in the 2020 elections. You certainly see some states, at least, notably Georgia at the moment, learning some of these lessons. Do you anticipate Georgia is going to be essentially now beset with the left and corporations and others engaging in what, well, in the case of Israel, we call the boycott, divestments, and sanctions kind of operation to dragoon them into abandoning these lessons learned?
I honestly think that those efforts are a bluff, but if you have a weak-kneed governor that will cave to it, then they certainly have their effect. And I was not impressed with Governor Kemp back in November, December, January. He had the opportunity to do what they have finally done this last week. They could have done that in a special session and prevented the U.S. Senate races from going the way that they did and chose not to. So I hope that that doesn't happen. They've been able to bully, you know, Governor Noem apparently and changing her mind on boys and girls sports. They did that in North Carolina and Indiana on the, you know, sexual revolution issues. And so, you know, it's interesting that they would take that same stance now on these election issues. But I was going to say one other thing about the forensic, you know, whether or not we will get to the bottom of what actually happened in 2020 in the election. And to be honest, Frank, I don't have a lot of hope that we will. And that even if we do find those things, that very little will be reported on it. And so even though we may not ever be able to, you know, to most people what happened, it's the you know, tightening our security. As I said, like, we're not going to catch the burglar, but we are going to tighten our security and prevent it from happening again, at least in some of these states. And I am hoping, I mean, even my own home state of Texas, there's an election, you know, integrity law coming through. Again, not nearly as, it doesn't go nearly as far as I would like it to go, but it will help to prevent some of this. This is going to be one of those long fights. I don't think we'll solve it overnight, but it's at the heart of how our republic works. And so I encourage citizens not to glaze over when we talk about this stuff, but to dive deeper into what really works and doesn't work and how we can get confidence back in our election.
And where can they learn more about how you do that work and how they can benefit from it, as well as your firearms and constitution training program?
Yeah, the best place to go is constitutioncoach.com, and they can sign up for any of our free courses. We give the constitution classes away for free. We do all kinds of training on the constitution, and then we have our actual in-person both firearms and constitution training, which is a great time of fellowship. It's a mask-free environment and a wonderful time, and I just had 300 people with me last week. We've got another one coming up April 25th.
Rick, we are hard out of time, but I wanted to make sure you had a chance to plug that. It's great and very encouraging. Thank you for joining us today. Come back to us again soon for more conversation about the Constitution and more. Next up, we'll speak with Rick Fisher, one of our duty experts on the Chinese military threat, including in space. You're not going to want to miss this. Stay tuned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back and joined by Rick Fisher, one of our country's preeminent experts on the military threat we are facing from the Chinese Communist Party and its People's Liberation Army. Rick is a senior fellow responsible for Asian military affairs at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He is widely published on topics related to the China threat, notably in his book, China's Military Modernization, Building for Regional and Global Reach. He's a good friend. We're always delighted to have him with us, a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China. And welcome back to you, Rick. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
In my commentary today, Rick, I expressed concern about the growing belligerence of the Chinese Communist Party, and I've pointed to several what I would call indicators and warnings of possible impending military action against Taiwan. How do you see the nature of the Chinese capabilities to mount an invasion of Taiwan? And do you think such a thing is possibly imminent at the moment?
Imminent is hard to tell, but an invasion of Taiwan has been hanging over the heads of the people of Taiwan and indeed the world for much of the last decade. When Xi Jinping, the leader of China, believes that he can win a war over Taiwan, then he will strike. The real kicker for the People's Liberation Army side is the fact that they have, for decades, mobilized all of their airliners and tens of thousands of civilian, quote-unquote, barges and ferries that would carry the bulk of an invading army's armor, artillery, and such. The Chinese have had the ability to do a D-Day, maybe to do three or four D-Days, if that's what it took. For a long time, what's holding them back is something that prevents them from approaching a certainty of success.
Meaning, the question of whether the United States might successfully interfere with their operations.
Well, of course, that an invasion of Taiwan would be the penultimate military operation in human history. And in order to succeed, of course, they would require phenomenal surprise. A trillion actions would have to come off sequentially and flawlessly. But the Americans could turn the day of the best luck into the day of the worst luck very easily.
This is a very interesting topic, and I think one of the things that I've really appreciated about your analysis of it, Rick, is what you've alluded to here, namely that much of this could be done from a standing start now. I'm told there's a new heliport that is being built opposite Taiwan in China that could, again, put it in a position, one operational, to have large numbers of Hellborn troops moved at lightning speed into the fray. And all of these things that conduce to a no warning or very little warning action, of course, might mitigate the danger of the United States interfering, or for that matter, the Taiwanese being adequately prepared for such an attack. You'll be watching it closely, I know, and we will, with your help, I hope, be staying abreast of these things. But let me turn to another topic that you've also devoted a lot of your research attention and energy to, Rick, I think very helpfully, and that is what the Chinese are doing now to dominate space, a project that your research indicates has been underway for a very long time. Tell us a little bit about the background as well as the status of those efforts at the moment.
Okay. Well, in my estimation, the Chinese Communist Party, after it successfully suppressed, killed its last existential threat that culminated in the Tiananmen Square protests, they made two decisions. The first decision was that because the outside world played such a fundamental role in promoting and encouraging what became the Tiananmen massacre, that the Chinese Communist Party decided in order to secure their dictatorship, they had to address this. They had to change the rest of the world. The survival did not rest with any kind of Gorbachev reform of themselves, but the rest of the world had to be suppressed and controlled in order for that dictatorship to survive. And then by about 1992, they decided that, okay, controlling the earth, being the hegemon on earth was not enough. We also have to be the hegemon in outer space. We have to control the Earth-Moon system. And so from 1992, the Chinese have been rolling out, developing, launching a phased space program, one that they can afford, but one that's always rolling, one that does not face funding difficulties, one that does not face the catastrophic decision that Barack Obama made on April 2010 to end the American moon program, return to the moon program, for basically no good reason at all. Now, the Chinese are looking at going to the moon, and when they go to the moon, they want to control the moon. After they go to the moon, they want to go to Mars, and ditto, they want to control Mars. And according to so much of their writing in the last decade, they want to go beyond Mars. They want to go to asteroids that are close and then asteroids that are far. They want to go to the moons of Jupiter, some of which may be promising in terms of habitability and resources. And then they want to go beyond. So I like to say that China has a plan to be the hegemon of our galaxy, as well as being the hegemon on Earth.
Yeah, this is chilling. There's clearly a military dimension to the space program. You've written about it being inherently dual use, but is it fair to say, Rick, that its first purpose isn't science or research of space? It's, as you say, the use of it for dominating both that high frontier, as it's been called, as well as what goes on Earth is below.
Well, yes, Frank. Dual use is a kind way of saying that the Chinese space program is a military enterprise. They write about wanting to be able to observe the Earth from the moon. Okay. You can observe the Earth from low Earth, medium, and high Earth orbits. It's a lot more expensive to observe the Earth from the moon. So why would you want to do that? Well, very clearly, the Chinese want to be able to find anything that is moving between the Earth and the moon. And the United States puts into very high orbits our very large and very classified early warning satellites and observation satellites. If you take those out, then you can achieve a Pearl Harbor nuclear attack on the United States. So, yes, indeed. When the Chinese go to the moon, the dual use benefits will accrue to the People's Liberation Army almost immediately. And in some cases, they're pretty open about it in the specific case of observing the Earth from the moon.
There's also aspects to this that are seemingly pretty highly classified for the Chinese, including, I gather, what they're doing on the backside of the moon, the dark side, if it, you will. What do we know about those activities, and are they likely to be the leading edge of efforts by the Chinese, Rick, to control the moon and to use it for purposes that may have to do with dominating the Earth as well?
Well, indeed, Frank. Going to the far side of the moon is not exactly classified. The United States has a satellite called LCROSS, the expansion. I don't remember at this point, but for almost a decade, maybe more, the LCROSS satellite has been going around and around the moon, taking pictures, so that when a Chinese probe like the Chang'e 14, which landed on the far side of the moon, touches down, within a matter of days or weeks, we can image it and know it's there and at least have some indication of what the Chinese are up to. But going to the far side of the moon is all about creating the ability to operate at the Lagrangian points. And the L2 Lagrangian point, which is like 65,000 miles on the other side of the moon, is important because it is a kind of balanced gravitational point due to the forces of the sun, the Earth, and the moon that makes it very easy with very little expenditure of fuel to maintain a satellite in that position. And so controlling the Lagrangian point is important if you're going to dominate the moon. And also, the Chinese and the United States plan to put satellites at L2 that are looking outward, that are going to be at the cutting edge of finding exoplanets or small planets that we cannot yet see that have been circling stars for billions of years.
So in short, and we have to wrap with this, Rick, we're looking at people who have a very long-term plan for, as you say, dominating the heavens, both the Earth and the Earth space system, or Earth-Moon system, including these Lagrangian points. And this is a topic to which I hope we can return with you soon, because it does seem to me it has very profound bearing on near-term capabilities and vital interests of this country as well. Thanks for your assiduous attention to these matters, Rick, and for bringing them to our attention and that of the rest of, I hope, Washington and the United States. It's of vital importance that we pay attention to what the Chinese are up to, not just here on Earth, but in the heavens as well. Keep up the great work, my friend, at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. Do come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we'll talk with Bill Walton about other aspects of what the Chinese are up to here on the Earth, including going after American companies and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and it's a special welcome that I am always happy to extend on Mondays to one of our regulars now, Bill Walton. He is a captain of finance, now recovering, now having thrown his energies into the public policy arena instead of Wall Street, to the betterment of our country, I believe. He is a leader of an important conservative organization, the Council for National Policy, of which I'm very pleased to be a member, and the host of an absolutely terrific podcast program, a television model on various platforms entitled The Bill Walton Show. And he's been kind enough to give us regularly of his time here and on our television program, Securing America. We're very pleased to have him always. Bill, welcome back.
Frank, great talking with you. You say recovering. I would put it more relieved given the volatility in the capital markets right now.
Bill, you have been spending a lot of time both bringing your business background and your interest in public policy to bear on what communist China is up to. And I'm always anxious to get the latest from you about the places that we see the Chinese using the economic warfare techniques and intelligence gathering vehicles against our country and against our corporations and well, citizens for that matter. One of the stories that popped up since we last talked is the efforts that the Chinese have taken to punish a large clothing retailer by the name of H&M that had some 500 stores in China for having the temerity to defy the party line on the genocide taking place in Xinjiang. Talk to us a little bit about what has happened to H&M and the signal that is clearly meant to be sending to the Chinese mean to be sending to other businesses operating in their country.
Well, the story here is that H&M is a Swedish retailer all over the world. They have roughly 500 stores in China, and China is using its economic leverage here to send a signal to the world. The thing to keep in mind about China, it is the largest consumer luxury goods market in the world, with roughly $400 to $500 billion of retail sales, and every consumer branded manufacturer, retailer wants to be in China. And that's not just H&M, but it's Nike, it's Burberry, it's all the other brands you can think of. And the management of H&M joined the cry against the human rights abuses in Xinjiang, which is, you know, you've got the million Uyghurs that are being forced into forced labor camps and engaging in re-education of these people. And they joined that cry, and what China did was they disappeared H&M, And now, if you're in China and you want to do a ride hail and go to your local H&M store, it's not there. And it's not on the internet. And so when you think about China, China is roughly largest in the world, roughly half of its retail sales are over the internet. And so by doing what they're doing to H&M, the Chinese Communist Party is saying, if you criticize us, we will erase you.
You know, I had a man who knows a lot about China from his time working actually for Chinese propaganda instruments, both in the country and in the United States, Lance Crayon, on the show last week, and he used a Chinese adage to describe what's going on here. He said the Chinese have an expression, kill the chicken to scare the monkey. And the point was very clear. The Chinese are making an example of H&M so as to not have to act against a number of these other Western companies that are doing business there. Is that your take?
You're exactly right. And, you know, they're very smart about this. If you look at the Target, Target's a Swedish-owned country, and the Chinese see that as much more susceptible to pressure because of its small size. In fact, the Chinese government a couple of years ago referred to Sweden as a lightweight boxer, which the Swedish government took a little offense to and should have. But the Chinese know if you send a signal like this, it's going to affect all the other brands. And Nike in particular, I think, has almost a third of its sales in China. The other thing they've done is they're doing this through the tech companies in China, and they're also under pressure from the Chinese Communist Party. The party's just announced a plan to put these platform companies under a Chinese Communist Party platform controlled by the Bank of China. So they're also particularly susceptible to coercion right now, and particularly eager to toe the line. Also, if you're an entertainer in China and you're endorsing one of these brands, you better stop. And they have stopped. There have been dozens and dozens of popular entertainers in China that have stopped endorsing not only H&M, but Nike, Burberry. Burberry's got one of its, I think it's Tencent. One of the apps, consumer apps, has Burberry as in the product placement, and they've been required to take Burberry out of the app. So it's pervasive, going into every nook and cranny.
And punitive, let's be clear. And for what? For having pointed out that they are not using a product of slave labor in China. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, I'm sure, of what's coming in terms of having to accommodate the Chinese Communist Party. Bill, let me go back to that point you just made about the Bank of China's facility. It sounds as though everybody's data is going to have to be migrating into that platform for the Chinese Communist Party's use, not just the social media platforms. Is that right? Or is that simply something that's in prospect? But either way, it would be very alarming given the hoovering up that the Chinese have been doing, both through legal means and illegal ones, of our data, no?
Well, the Chinese have been sending a lot of very strong messages for the past year or more about the growing power of the internet companies, platform companies. And you're right, the platform companies, you know, ranges from ride sharing to financial services to insurance to online shopping to medical services. In other words, every single thing we buy, whether it's a product or service, would be considered a part of a platform company. And what has happened is the Chinese have let the billionaires like Jack Ma grow and build their companies as entrepreneurs. But the thing to keep in mind is Jack Ma is also a member of the Chinese Communist Party. But even there, they're trying to rein in the power to make sure that they have control, because they are, particularly with something like fintech, which is providing financial services away from traditional commercial banks, that's growing like a weed. And these big Chinese platform companies are real players in this area, and that's a real concern to the party.
One of the things that we've talked about regularly with one of our other contributors, David Goldman, of Asia Times, the author of a book entitled You Will Be Assimilated, chillingly enough, talks about the emphasis that the Chinese are making on combining big data, as it's called, the aggregation of all of this kind of information, including intimate details about individuals' personal lives. You mentioned their health data, genomic sequencing, and the like, among other things. But utilizing it with artificial intelligence and quantum computing and similar techniques to try to achieve a degree of knowledge and exploitable information that could become really dominant in the next, you know, industrial revolution, as it's called, and a vehicle for the sort of control that we know the Chinese Communist Party aspires to have worldwide. Do you share that concern?
Well, I do. But if you're in China, remember the China culture is not one that's based on freedom. It's based on many other good virtues, bourgeois virtues that you know, make them very successful entrepreneurs. But freedom's not high on their list. And if you're Chinese, your information, your life has already been fairly well circumscribed. How many tens of millions of facial recognition cameras are already there? The artificial intelligence allows somebody to be identified almost anywhere in the country within 5 minutes. And they're pretty used to this level of surveillance. And now it's going to be gathered up via this Chinese central bank initiative. I don't think that really is a life changer, game changer for them. It's pretty much business as usual. But you're right. If the techniques, the technologies, the things they're doing to aggregate this data in China, well, those are things that could be emulated elsewhere in the world. I know the Chinese would like to be gathering that information from all over the world and probably already are through apps like TikTok. But this could become a lot more pervasive. You and I talk about the enemy without, which is China, but also the enemy within. And just recently, in the last couple of weeks, we're seeing hearings in Congress where Democrats in Congress are assailing the tech companies, our tech companies like Facebook and YouTube and Google, to begin to do more to rein in speech on the internet. And it's a pretty short step from getting clamors from congressmen to CEOs of tech companies to do their bidding to moving into something like the Chinese are doing. That's the concern.
It's very similar, isn't it, in at least the broad outlines. Bill Walton, fascinating topic for continuing in our conversation next week.
There's a lot to talk about here, Frank.
There is indeed. Thank you for helping us plummet. We'll be back to you next week. In the meantime, thank you for all you do, my friend, at the Council for National Policy and elsewhere. Next up, we will be speaking with Kyle Scheidler about the enemy within and are we properly understanding who it is, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're joined by one of my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy. It's Director and Senior Analyst for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. His name is Kyle Scheidler. He is the editor of a terrific, relatively recent book called Unmasking Antifa, which provides five perspectives on a growing threat. He also gave some very important testimony back in August of last year about Antifa before the Senate Judiciary Committee's Constitution Subcommittee. He is a remarkable resource. We're always delighted to have him on the program. Kyle, again, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Always a pleasure.
A lot to cover with you in a short period of time. Let's start with what we have learned about and what we are having a hard time hearing much of concerning the attack that took place by a gunman in Boulder, Colorado in the past week or two. What is it that is so hard to tell us about the nature of the individual who did the shooting and the nature of his target.
So this shooting took place at a Colorado Boulder grocery store. The gunman was a 21-year-old named Ahmed Al-Issa, originally from Syria. He immigrated as a very young child, as far as we understand. Now, originally, the media identified him as Alyssa, last name Alyssa, which, of course, is not correct and is somewhat misleading. We do know now that he killed 10 people in that shooting. Information about his motive was originally somewhat limited. We have had testimony from people who knew him in high school that he was relatively paranoid, that he had he routinely complained of Islamophobia and similar issues. Our fellow here at the Center for Security Policy, Zudi Jasser, recently said that his examination of the shooter's social media suggested to him that Al-Issa had deeply internalized various Islamist propaganda about Islamophobia. And I think that rings true. But the media, of course, is not very interested in covering that issue. So we do have sort of two running theories right now. One would be a question of a history of mental illness, and then the other would be the impact of Islamist propaganda perpetuating American Muslims as victims, as needing to get revenge for the way they are treated. So that's sort of the two theories we have right
now. Yeah. The other piece of this is that I'm told, Kyle, that the grocery store was widely advertised as a kosher grocery and delicatessen catering to the Jewish community in Boulder, and that may have had something to do with the selection of the target and sort of have a jihadist character to the nature of the attack. Have you come across that as well?
I have not affirmed that, but obviously if that were the case, we have seen similar incidents across the globe that it would fall into a well-known pattern. I mean, certainly had a situation in France a few years ago, very similar situation with an attack on a Jewish kosher deli or grocery store.
It's worth investigating further because I think that's the case. Let me turn to the larger question of domestic terrorism. We're told incessantly these days, Kyle, as you know, that the great danger we face is from white supremacists and nationalists and constitutionalists and the like. You and I have discussed some of the provenance of this narrative dating back to the Obama years when Muslim Brotherhood operatives were informing the Department of Homeland Security's advisory committee about the violent extremists that weren't actually of a jihadist character. This has now been sort of re-upped and formalized in the latest report out of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Tell us a bit about this report and what you made of it.
So in early March, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which is responsible for overseeing the entire American intelligence community, the CIA and everything that flows through it, issued a report on domestic violent extremists. And they listed a number of categories that the government has been using for a while now. Racial and ethnically motivated violent extremists, that's their word for white supremacists. It also used to be their word for black supremacists or black nationalists because they're no longer allowed to use the term black identity extremism. But if you looked at the language of the ODNI assessment, they eliminated that possibility because they described racial and ethnically motivated violent extremists as being motivated by bias against minorities, which, of course, would presume to exclude either minorities with biases against other minorities or with biases against the presumable majority. So then you would be only talking about white supremacists. So through this obfuscation of the language, they managed to limit and reduce the scope of the possible threats that we can discuss. And in the nature of the government, if you can't categorize something and you don't have a term for it, it doesn't get investigated. If it doesn't get investigated, it doesn't exist. And so this is the problem that we have.
This is a serious problem, it does seem to me, because it drives both the adequate understanding of the threat, but also, obviously, Kyle, as you know so well, steps taken to mitigate it. And if you're giving a complete pass to not only, well, one black identity extremist group, the Black Lives Matter organization comes to mind, but seemingly also Antifa as a threat domestically, you're clearly missing a big part of what's out there and what we're going to see, I'm afraid, more of in the days ahead, especially if this trial in this trial in Minnesota of the police officer who was involved in the murder of was involved in the death of George Floyd goes badly from their perspective. We'll be watching that closely, as I know will you, Kyle Scheidler. Let me ask you. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, you know, Frank, one of the things that is interesting is the ODNI report does mention anarchist extremists, which is the term that the government typically uses for Antifa. But if you look at their definition, it was almost sympathetic. They described anarchist extremists as having concerns about capitalism and globalization's effect, negative effects on society. That was it. That was the extent of their description of what anarchist extremism is. And by comparison, their references to what they called militia violent extremism referred to attempts to overthrow the government. Well, if anarchists are not trying to overthrow the government, what are they doing?
Yeah,
right?
I mean, this is, they're kind of missing the point.
This is pretty 101 stuff.
It is,
and
indeed. Very worrying.
It's ironic. It's ironic because, you know, just over the weekend, we had a major incident outside the Salem, Oregon Capitol building with armed Antifa engaging in melees. And this was the kind of thing they told us was going to happen at state capitals. But they said it was going to come from Trump supporters and these January 6th types. So it seems to me that they entirely inverted the outcome on these things. And if your analysis doesn't have predictive capability, what good is it?
Except misleading you into inaction in the face of real and present dangers. Kyle, this is one of the reasons why we appreciate so much your insights and expertise, is you do not miss these important points. Let me ask you quickly about a woman who has been tapped by Joe Biden to become the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Vanita Gupta, who seems to have some pretty extreme views on racism in this country. Kyle, what can you tell us about her, and what would it mean for the Department of Justice and its role to have such a person involved in that important post?
Well, so my interest in this was highlighted as Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas had a back and forth with Gupta about statements she had made regarding the institutionalized racism of the U.S. government and the notion that all Americans have an implicit racial bias. And this concerned me, of course, because if you are defining extremism in the way that the ODNI did, that I mentioned earlier, defining it as merely motivations of bias, and then you have people who are coming into the DOJ who define every American as biased, then it doesn't take too long to put those two together and realize that essentially there is no one in this country that they could not accuse of violent extremism, which, of course, is absurd.
Kyle, we are hard out of time, but this is a topic to which I hope we can return with you very soon, because her nomination is, I think, somewhat embattled, shall we say, in the Senate, and with good reason. We will want to amplify on these points for purposes of helping illuminate why this nomination should be opposed. Thank you for your time today, Kyle, and for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy day in and day out. We'll talk with you again very soon. Hope that we'll have a chance to talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.